as are all guns, explosives, and ammunition. All operational vehicles will be impounded. All windows will be equipped with material for blackout, and you shall use it. A 9 p.m. curfew is instantly in effect. No light shall be on after dusk. We will control all food, whether grown or imported. He paused, looked out over the mass of people standing in front of him. Not so bad, see? We will live together in harmony, yes? But know this. Any act of sabotage or espionage or resistance will be dealt with swiftly and without mercy. The punishment for such behavior is death by execution. He pulled a pack of cigarettes from his breast pocket and extracted a single cigarette. Lighting it, he stared out at the people so intently it seemed he was memorizing each face. Also, although many of your ragged, cowardly soldiers are returning, we must inform you that the men taken prisoner by us shall remain in Germany. Vian felt confusion ripple through the audience. She looked at Rachel, whose square face was blotchy in places, a sign of anxiety. Mark and Antoine will come home, Rachel said stubbornly. The Sternbahnfuhrer went on. You may leave now, as I am sure we understand each other. I will have officers here until 8:45 tonight. They will receive your contraband. Do not be late. And, he smiled good-naturedly, do not risk your lives to keep a radio. Whatever you keep or hide, we will find, and if we find it, death. He said it so casually, and wearing such a fine smile, that for a moment it didn't sink in. The crowd stood there a moment longer, uncertain whether it was safe to move. No one wanted to be seen as taking the first step. And then suddenly, they were moving, pack-like, toward the open doors that led them outside. Bastards, Isabel said as they moved into an alley. And I was so sure they'd let us keep our guns, Rachel said, lighting up a cigarette, inhaling deeply and exhaling in a rush. I'm keeping our gun, I can tell you, Isabel said in a loud voice, and our radio. Shh, Vian said. General de Gaulle thinks, I don't want to hear that foolishness. We have to keep our heads down until our men come home, Vian said. Mon Dieu, Isabel said sharply. You think your husband can fix this? No, Vian said. I believe you will fix it, you and your General de Gaulle, of whom no one has ever heard. Now come. While you are hatching a plan to save France, I need to tend to my garden. Come on, Rachel, let us dullards be away. Vian held tightly to Sophie's hand and walked briskly ahead. She did not bother to glance back to see if Isabel was following. She knew her sister was back there, hobbling forward on her damaged feet. Ordinarily, Vian would keep pace with her sister out of politeness, but just now she was too mad to care. Your sister may not be so wrong, Rachel said as they passed the Norman church on the edge of town. If you take her side in this, I may be forced to hurt you, Rachel. That being said, your sister may not be entirely wrong. Vian sighed. Don't tell her that. She's unbearable already. She will have to learn propriety. You teach her. She has proven singularly resistant to improving herself or listening to reason. She's been to 2 finishing schools and still can't hold her tongue or make polite conversation. 2 days ago, instead of going to town for meat, she hid the valuables and created a hiding place for us, just in case. I should probably hide mine, too. Not that we have much. Vian pursed her lips. There was no point in talking further about this. Soon Antoine would be home, and he would help keep Isabel in line. At the gate to Le Jardin, Vian said goodbye to Rachel and her children, who kept walking.
Why do we have to give them our radio, Maman? Sophie asked. It belongs to Papa.
We don't, Isabel said, coming up beside them. We will hide it.
We will not hide it, Vian said sharply.
We will do as we are told and keep quiet, and soon Antoine will be home, and he will know what to do. Welcome to the Middle Ages, Sophie, Isabel said.
Vianne yanked her gate open, forgetting a second too late that the refugees had broken it. The poor thing clattered on its single hinge. It took all of Vianne's fortitude to act as if it hadn't happened. She marched up to the house, opened the door, and immediately turned on the kitchen light. Sophie, she said, unpinning her hat, would you please set the table?
Vianne ignored her daughter's grumbling. It was to be expected. In only a few days, Isabel had taught her niece to challenge authority.
Vianne lit the stove and started cooking. When a creamy potato and lardon soup was simmering, she began to clean up. Of course, Isabel was nowhere around to help. Sighing, she filled the sink with water to wash dishes. She was so intent on her task that it took her a moment to notice that someone was knocking on the front door. Patting her hair, she walked into the living room, where she found Isabel rising from the divan, a book in her hands. Reading while Vianne cooked and cleaned, naturally.
Are you expecting anyone? Isabel asked.
Vianne shook her head.
Maybe we shouldn't answer, Isabel said. Pretend we're not here.
It's most likely Rachel. There was another knock at the door. Slowly, the doorknob turned, and the door creaked open. Yes, of course it was Rachel. Who else would? A German soldier stepped into her home.
Oh, my pardons,
the man said in terrible French. He removed his military hat, tucked it in his armpit, and smiled. He was a good-looking man, tall and broad-shouldered and narrow-hipped, with pale skin and light gray eyes. Vianne guessed he was roughly her age. His field uniform was precisely pressed and looked brand new. An iron cross decorated his stand-up collar. Binoculars hung from a strap around his neck, and a chunky leather utility belt cinched his waist. Behind him, through the branches of the orchard, she saw his motorcycle parked on the side of the road. A sidecar was attached to it, mounted with machine guns.
Mademoiselle, he said to Vianne, giving her a swift nod as he clicked his boots together.
Madame, she corrected him, wishing she sounded haughty and in control, but even to her own ears she sounded scared. Madame Mauriac.
I am Hauptmann, Captain Wolfgang Beck.
He handed her a piece of paper and clicked his heels together again.
My French is not so good. You will excuse my ineptitude, please.
When he smiled, deep dimples formed in his cheeks. She took the paper and frowned down at it.
I don't read German. What do you want? Isabel demanded, coming to stand by Vianne.
Your home is most beautiful and very close to the airfield. I noticed it upon our arrival. How many bedrooms have you?
Why, Isabel said at the same time Vianne said, three.
I will billet here,
the captain said in his bad French.
Billet? Vianne said. You mean to stay?
Oui, madame.
Billet? You? A man? A Nazi? No. No.
Isabel shook her head.
No.
The captain's smile neither faded nor fell.
You were to town, he said, looking at Isabel. I saw you when we arrived.
You noticed me?
He smiled.
I am sure every red-blooded man in my regiment noticed you.
Funny you would mention blood, Isabel said.
Vianne elbowed her sister.
I am sorry, Captain. My young sister is obstinate on occasion. But I am married, you see, and my husband is at the front, and there is my sister and my daughter here, so you must see how inappropriate it would be to have you here.
Ah, so you would rather leave the house to me. How difficult that must be for you.
Leave? Vianne said. I believe you aren't understanding the captain, Isabel said, not taking her gaze from him.
He's moving into your home, taking it over, really, and that piece of paper is a requisition order that makes it possible. And Pétain's armistice, of course. We can either make room for him or abandon a home that has been in our family for generations.
He looked uncomfortable.
This, I'm afraid, is the situation. Many of your fellow villagers are facing the same dilemma, I fear.
If we leave, will we get our home back? Isabel asked.
I would not think so, madame.
Vianne dared to take a step toward him. Perhaps she could reason with him.
My husband will be home any day now, I imagine. Perhaps you could wait until he is here?
I am not the general, alas. I am simply a captain in the Wehrmacht. I follow orders, madame. I do not give them. And I am ordered to billet here. But I assure you that I am a gentleman.
We will leave, Isabel said. Leave?
Vianne said to her sister in disbelief.
This is my home.
To the captain, she said,
I can count on you to be a gentleman?
Of course.
Vianne looked at Isabel, who shook her head slowly. Vianne knew there was no real choice. She had to keep Sophie safe until Antoine came home, and then he would handle this unpleasantness. Surely he would be home soon, now that the armistice had been signed.
There is a small bedroom downstairs. You'll be comfortable there.
The captain nodded.
Merci, madame. I will get my things.
As soon as the door closed behind the captain, Isabel said,
Are you mad? We can't live with a Nazi.
He said he's in the Wehrmacht. Is that the same thing?
I'm hardly interested in their chain of command. You haven't seen what they're willing to do to us, Vianne. I have. We'll leave. Go next door, to Rachel's. We could live with her.
Rachel's house is too small for all of us, and I am not going to abandon my home to the Germans.
To that, Isabel had no answer. Vianne felt anxiety turn to an itch along her throat. An old nervous habit returned.
You go if you must, but I'm waiting for Antoine. We have surrendered, so he'll be home soon.
Vianne, please.
The front door rattled hard. Another knock. Vianne walked dully forward. With a shaking hand, she reached for the knob and opened the door. Captain Beck stood there, holding his military hat in one hand and a small leather valise in the other. He said,
Hello again, madame,
as if he'd been gone for some time. Vianne scratched at her neck, feeling acutely vulnerable beneath this man's gaze. She backed away quickly, saying,
This way, Herr Captain.
As she turned, she saw the living room that had been decorated by three generations of her family's women. Golden stucco walls, the color of freshly baked brioche, gray stone floors covered by ancient Aubusson rugs, heavily carved wooden furniture upholstered in mohair and tapestry fabric, lamps made of porcelain, curtains of gold and red toile, antiques and treasures left over from the years when the Rossignols had been wealthy tradesmen. Until recently, there had been artwork on the walls. Now only the unimportant pieces remained. Isabel had hidden the good ones. Vianne walked past all of it to the small guest bedroom tucked beneath the stairs. At the closed door, to the left of the bathroom that had been added in the early 20s, she paused. She could hear him breathing behind her. She opened the door to reveal a narrow room with a large window, bracketed by blue-gray curtains that pooled on the wooden floor. A painted chest of drawers supported a blue pitcher and ewer. In the corner was an aged oak armoire with mirrored doors. By the double bed sat a nightstand. On it, an antique ormolu clock. Isabel's clothes lay everywhere, as if she were packing for an extended holiday. Vianne picked them up quickly, and the valise, too. When she finished, she turned. His suitcase plunked to the floor. She looked at him, compelled by simple politeness to offer a tense smile.
You needn't worry, madame, he said gently. We have been admonished to act as gentlemen. My mother would demand the same, and in truth, she scares me more than my general."
It was such an ordinary remark that Vian was taken aback. She had no idea how to respond to this stranger who dressed like the enemy and looked like a young man she might have met at church. And what was the price for saying the wrong thing? He remained where he was, a respectful distance from her.
"I apologize for any inconvenience, madame."
"My husband will be home soon."
"We all hope to be home soon."
Another unnerving comment. Vian nodded politely and left him alone in the room, closing the door behind her.
"Tell me he's not staying," Isabel said, rushing at her.
"He says he is," Vian said tiredly, pushing back the hair from her eyes. She realized just now that she was trembling.
"I know how you feel about these Nazis. Just make sure he doesn't know it. I won't let you put Sophie at risk with your childish rebellion."
"Childish rebellion? Are you?" The guest room door opened, silencing Isabel. Captain Beck strode confidently toward them, smiling broadly. Then he saw the radio in the room and he paused.
"Do not worry, ladies. I am most pleased to deliver your radio to the commandant."
"Really?" Isabel said. "You consider this a kindness?"
Vian felt a tightening in her chest. There was a storm brewing in Isabel. Her sister's cheeks had gone pale. Her lips were drawn in a thin, colorless line. Her eyes were narrowed. She was glaring at the German as if she could kill him with a look.
"Of course,"
he smiled, looking a little confused. The sudden silence seemed to unnerve him. Suddenly he said,
"You have beautiful hair, mademoiselle."
At Isabel's frown, he said,
"This is an appropriate compliment, yes?"
"Do you think so?"
Isabel said, her voice low.
"Quite lovely."
Beck smiled. Isabel walked into the kitchen and came back with a pair of boning shears. His smile faded.
"Am I misunderstood?"
Vian said.
"Isabel, don't."
Just as Isabel gathered up her thick blonde hair and fisted it. Staring grimly at Captain Beck's handsome face, she hacked off her hair and handed the long blonde tail to him.
"It must be verboten for us to have anything beautiful, is it not, Captain Beck?"
Vian gasped.
"Please, sir, ignore her. Isabel is a silly, prideful girl."
"No," Beck said. "She is angry, and angry people make mistakes in war and die."
"So do conquering soldiers," Isabel snapped.
Beck laughed at her. Isabel made a sound that was practically a snarl and pivoted on her heel. She marched up the stairs and slammed the door shut so hard the house shook.
"You will want to speak to her now, I warrant," Beck said.
He looked at Vian in a way that made it seem as if they understood each other.
Such theatrics in the wrong place could be most dangerous.
Vian left him standing in her living room and went upstairs. She found Isabel sitting on Sophie's bed, so angry she was shaking. Scratches marred her cheeks and throat, a reminder of what she'd seen and survived. And now her hair was hacked off, the ends uneven. Vian tossed Isabel's belongings onto the unmade bed and closed the door behind her.
"What in the name of all that's holy were you thinking? I could kill him in his sleep, just slit his throat. And do you think they would not come looking for a captain who had orders to billet here? Mon Dieu, Isabel."
She took a deep breath to calm her racing nerves.
"I know there are problems between us, Isabel. I know I treated you badly as a child. I was too young and scared to help you, and Papa treated you worse. But this is not about us now, and you can't be the girl who acts impetuously anymore. It is about my daughter now, your niece. We must protect her."
"But..."
"France has surrendered, Isabel. Certainly this fact has not escaped you."
Didn't you hear General de Gaulle? He said... And who is this General de Gaulle? Why should we listen to him? Maréchal Pétain is a war hero and our leader. We have to trust our government.
Are you joking, Vian?
The government in Vichy is collaborating with Hitler. How can you not understand this danger? Pétain is wrong. Does one follow a leader blindly?
Vian moved toward Isabel slowly, half afraid of her now.
You don't remember the last war, she said, clasping her hands to still them. I do. I remember the fathers and brothers and uncles who didn't come home. I remember hearing children in my class cry quietly when bad news came by telegram. And I remember the men who came home on crutches, their pant legs empty and flapping, or one arm gone, or a face ruined. I remember how Papa was before the war, and how different he was when he came home. How he drank and slammed doors and screamed at us, and then when he stopped. I remember the stories about Verdun and Somme and a million Frenchmen dying in trenches that ran red with blood. And the German atrocities, don't forget that part of it. They were cruel, Isabel.
That's my point, exactly. We must...
They were cruel because we were at war with them, Isabel. Pétain has saved us from going through that again. He has kept us safe. He has stopped the war. Now Antoine and all our men will come home.
To a Heil Hitler world?
Isabel said with a sneer.
The flame of French resistance must not and shall not die. That's what de Gaulle said. We have to fight however we can, for France vie, so it stays France.
Enough, Vian said.
She moved close enough that she could have whispered to Isabel, or kissed her, but Vian did neither. In a steady, even voice, she said,
You will take Sophie's room upstairs and she will move in with me. And remember this, Isabel. He could shoot us. Shoot us, and no one would care. You will not provoke this soldier in my home.
She saw the words hit home. Isabel stiffened.
I will try to hold my tongue.
Do more than try.
Chapter 9 Vian closed the bedroom door and leaned against it, trying to calm her nerves. She could hear Isabel pacing in the room behind her, moving with an anger that made the floorboards tremble. How long did Vian stand there alone, trembling, trying to get her nerves under control? It felt like hours passed while she struggled with her fear. In ordinary times, she would have found the strength to talk rationally with her sister, to say some of the things that had long been unspoken. Vian would have told Isabel how sorry she was for the way she'd treated her as a little girl. Maybe she could have made Isabel understand. Vian had been so helpless after Maman's death. When Papa had sent them away, to live in this small town, beneath the cold, stern eyes of a woman who had shown the girls no love, Vian had wilted. In another time, she might have shared with Isabel what they had in common. How undone she'd been by Maman's death. How Papa's rejection had broken her heart. Or how he'd treated her at 16 when she'd come to him, pregnant and in love, and been slapped across the face and called a disgrace. How Antoine had pushed Papa back hard and said, I'm going to marry her. And Papa's answer, Fine, she's all yours. You can have the house. But you'll take her squalling sister, too. Vian closed her eyes. She hated to think about all of that. For years, she'd practically forgotten it. Now, how could she push it aside? She had done to Isabel exactly what their father had done to them. It was the greatest regret of Vian's life. But this was not the time to repair that damage. Now she had to do everything in her power to keep Sophie safe until Antoine came home. Isabel would simply have to be made to understand that. With a sigh, she went downstairs to check on supper. In the kitchen, she found her potato soup simmering a bit too briskly, so she uncovered it and lowered the heat.
Madame, are you sanguine?
She flinched at the sound of his voice. When had he come in here? She took a deep breath and patted her hair. It was not the word he meant. Really, his French was terrible.
That smells delicious, he said, coming up behind her.
She set the wooden spoon down on the rest beside the stove.
May I see what you are making?
Of course, she said, both of them pretending her wishes mattered. It's just potato soup.
My wife, alas, is not much of a cook.
He was right beside her now, taking Antoine's place, a hungry man peering down at a cooking dinner.
You are married, she said, reassured by it, although she couldn't say why.
And a baby soon to be born. We are planning to call him Wilhelm, although I will not be there when he is born, and of course such decisions must inevitably be his mother's.
It was such a human thing to say. She found herself turning slightly to look at him. He was her height, almost exactly, and it unnerved her. Looking directly into his eyes made her feel vulnerable.
God willing, we will all be home soon, he said.
He wants this over too, she thought, with relief.
It's supper time, Herr Captain. Will you be joining us?
It would be an honor, madame. Although you will be pleased to hear that most evenings I will be working late and enjoying my supper with the officers. I shall also often be out on campaigns. You shall sometimes hardly notice my presence.
Vianne left him in the kitchen and carried silverware into the dining room, where she almost ran into Isabel.
You shouldn't be alone with him,
Isabel hissed. The captain came into the room.
You cannot think I would accept your hospitality and then do harm. Consider this night. I have brought you wine, a lovely Sancerre.
You brought us wine, Isabel said.
As any good guest would, he answered.
Vianne thought, oh no. But there was nothing she could do to stop Isabel from speaking.
You know about Tours, Herr Captain, Isabel asked. How your Stukas fired on innocent women and children who were fleeing for their lives and dropped bombs on us?
Us? He said,
his expression turning thoughtful.
I was there. You see the marks on my face.
Ah, he said. That must have been most unpleasant.
Isabel went very still. The green of her eyes seemed to blaze against the red marks and bruises on her pale skin.
Unpleasant.
Think about Sophie, Vianne reminded her evenly.
Isabel gritted her teeth and then turned it into a fake smile.
Here, Captain Beck, let me show you to your seat.
Vianne took her first decent breath in at least an hour. Then, slowly, she headed into the kitchen to dish up supper. Vianne served supper in silence. The atmosphere at the table was as heavy as coal soot settling on all of them. It frayed Vianne's nerves to the breaking point. Outside, the sun began to set. Pink light filled the windows.
Would you care for wine, mademoiselle?
Beck said to Isabel, pouring himself a large glass of the Sancerre he had brought to the table.
If ordinary French families can't afford to drink it, Herr Captain, how can I enjoy it?
A sip, perhaps, would not be.
Isabel finished her soup and got to her feet.
Excuse me, I'm feeling sick to my stomach. Me too, Sophie said.
She got to her feet and followed her aunt out of the room like a puppy follows the lead dog, with her head down. Vianne sat perfectly still, her soup spoon held above her bowl. They were leaving her alone with him. Her breathing was a flutter in her chest. She carefully set down her spoon and dabbed at her mouth with her serviette.
Forgive my sister, Herr Captain. She is impetuous and willful.
My oldest daughter is such a girl. We expect nothing but trouble when she gets a little older.
That surprised Vianne so much that she turned. You have a daughter?
Gisela, he said, his mouth curving into a smile. She is 6, and already her mother is unable to get her to reliably do the simplest of tasks, like brush her teeth. Our Gisela would rather build a fort than read a book.
He sighed, smiling. It flustered her, knowing this about him. She tried to think of a response, but her nerves were too overwrought. She picked up her spoon and began eating again. The meal seemed to go on forever, in a silence that was her undoing. The moment he finished, saying, "A lovely meal, my thanks," she got to her feet and began clearing the table. Thankfully, he didn't follow her into the kitchen. He remained in the dining room, at the table by himself, drinking the wine he'd brought, which she knew would have tasted of autumn, pears and apples. By the time she'd washed and dried the dishes and put them away, night had fallen. She left the house, stepping into the starlit front yard for a moment's peace. On the stone garden wall, a shadow moved. It was a cat, perhaps. Behind her, she heard a footfall, then a match strike and the smell of sulfur. She took a quiet step backward, wanting to melt into the shadows. If she could move quietly enough, perhaps she could return by the side door without alerting him to her presence. She stepped on a twig, heard it snap beneath her heel, and she froze. He stepped out from the orchard.
"Madame," he said, "so you love the starlight also? I am sorry to intrude upon you."
She was afraid to move. He closed the distance between them, taking up a place beside her as if he belonged there, looking out across her orchard.
"You would never know there is a war on out here," he said.
Vian thought he sounded sad, and it reminded her that they were alike in a way, both of them far away from the people they loved.
"Your superior, he said that all prisoners of war will remain in Germany. What does this mean? What of our soldiers? Surely you did not capture all of them?"
"I do not know, madame. Some will return, many will not."
"Well, isn't this a lovely little moment between new friends?" Isabel said, her voice as sharp as cut steel.
Vian flinched, horrified that she'd been caught standing out here with a German, the enemy, a man. Isabel stood in the moonlight, wearing a caramel-colored suit. She held her valise in one hand and Vian's best Deauville in the other.
"You have my hat," Vian said. "I may have to wait for a train. My face is still tender from the Nazi attack."
She was smiling at Beck as she said this. It wasn't really a smile. Beck inclined his head in a curt nod.
"You have sisterly things to discuss, obviously. I will take my leave."
With a brisk, polite nod, he returned to the house, closing the door behind him.
"I can't stay here," Isabel said.
"Of course you can.
I have no interest in making friends with the enemy, V."
"Damn it, Isabel. Don't you dare."
Isabel stepped closer.
"I'll put you and Sophie at risk, sooner or later. You know I will. You told me I needed to protect Sophie. This is the only way I can do it. I feel like I'll explode if I stay, V."
Vian's anger dissolved. Without it, she felt inexpressibly tired. This essential difference had always been between them. Vian, the rule follower, and Isabel, the rebel. Even in girlhood, in grief, they had expressed their emotions differently. Vian had gone silent after Maman's death, tried to pretend that Papa's abandonment didn't wound her, while Isabel had thrown tantrums and run away and demanded attention. Maman had sworn that one day they would be the best of friends. Never had this prediction seemed less likely. In this right now, Isabel was right. Vian would be constantly afraid of what her sister would say or do around the captain. And truthfully, Vian hadn't the strength for it.
"How will you go? And where?" "Train. To Paris. I'll telegram you when I arrive safely.
Be careful. Don't do anything foolish.
Me? You know better than that.
Vian pulled Isabel into a fierce embrace and then let her go. The road to town was so dark, Isabel couldn't see her own feet. It was preternaturally quiet, suspenseful as a held breath, until she came to the airfield. There, she heard boots marching on hard-packed dirt, motorcycles and trucks rolling alongside the skein of barbed wire that now protected the ammunitions dump. A lorry appeared out of nowhere, its headlamps off, thundering up the road. She lurched out of its way, stumbling into the ditch. In town, it was no easier to navigate with the shops closed and the street lamps off and the windows blacked out. The silence was eerie and unnerving. Her footsteps seemed too loud. With every step, she was aware that a curfew was in effect and she was violating it. She ducked into one of the alleys, feeling her way along the rough sidewalk, her fingertips trailing along the storefronts for guidance. Whenever she heard voices, she froze, shrinking into the shadows until silence returned. It seemed to take forever to reach her destination, the train station on the edge of town.
Halt!
Isabel heard the word at the same time a floodlight sprayed white light over her. She was a shadow hunched beneath it. A German sentry approached her, his rifle held in his arms.
You are just a girl, he said, drawing close. You know about the curfew, ja?
He demanded. She rose slowly, facing him with a courage she didn't feel.
I know we aren't allowed to be out this late. It's an emergency, though. I must go to Paris. My father is ill.
Where is your Ausweis?
I don't have one.
He eased the rifle off his shoulder and into his hands.
No travel without an Ausweis.
But...
Go home, girl, before you get hurt.
But...
Now, before I decide not to ignore you.
Inside, Isabel was screaming in frustration. It took considerable effort to walk away from the sentry without saying anything. On the way home, she didn't even keep to the shadows. She flaunted her disregard of the curfew, daring them to stop her again. A part of her wanted to get caught so she could let loose the string of invective screaming inside her head. This could not be her life. Trapped in a house with a Nazi in a town that had given up without a whimper of protest. Vian was not alone in her desire to pretend that France had neither surrendered nor been conquered. In town, the shopkeepers and bistro owners smiled at the Germans and poured them champagne and sold them the best cuts of meat. The villagers, peasants mostly, shrugged and went on with life. Oh, they muttered disapprovingly and shook their heads and gave out wrong directions when asked. But beyond those small rebellions, there was nothing. No wonder the German soldiers were swollen with arrogance. They had taken over this town without a fight. Hell, they had done the same thing to all of France. But Isabel could never forget what she'd seen in the field near Tours. At home, when she was upstairs again, in the bedroom that had been hers as a child, she slammed the door shut behind her. A few moments later, she smelled cigarette smoke, and it made her so angry she wanted to scream. He was down there smoking a cigarette. Captain Beck, with his cut-stone face and fake smile, could toss them all out of this house at will. For any reason or no reason at all. Her frustration curdled into an anger that was like nothing she'd ever known. She felt as if her insides were a bomb that needed to go off. One wrong move or word, and she might explode. She marched over to Vian's bedroom and opened the door.
You need a pass to leave town, she said, her anger expanding. The bastards won't let us take a train to see family.
From the darkness, Vian said,
So, that's that.
Isabel didn't know if it was relief or disappointment she heard in her sister's voice. Tomorrow you will go to town for me. You will stand in the queues while I am at school and get what you can.
But...
No buts, Isabel. You are here now and staying. It's time you pulled your weight. I need to be able to count on you.
For the next week, Isabel tried to be on her best behavior. But it was impossible with that man living under the same roof. Night after night, she didn't sleep. She lay in her bed, alone in the dark, imagining the worst. This morning, well before dawn, she gave up the pretense and got out of bed. She washed her face and dressed in a plain cotton day dress, wrapping a scarf around her butchered hair as she went downstairs. Vian sat on the divan, knitting, an oil lamp lit beside her. In the ring of lamplight that separated her from the darkness, Vian looked pale and sickly. She obviously hadn't slept much this week either. She looked up at Isabel in surprise.
"You're up early."
"I have a long day of standing in lines ahead of me. Might as well get started," Isabel said. "The first in line gets the best food."
Vian put her knitting aside and stood, smoothing her dress. Another reminder that he was in the house. Neither of them came downstairs in nightdresses. She went into the kitchen and then returned with ration cards.
"It's meat today."
Isabel grabbed the ration cards from Vian and left the house, plunging into the darkness of a blacked-out world. Dawn rose as she walked, illuminating a world within a world, one that looked like Karavo but felt entirely foreign. As she passed the airfield, a small green car with the letters P-O-L on the rear roared past her. Gestapo. The airfield was already a hive of activity. She saw four guards out front, two at the newly constructed gated entrance and two at the building's double doors. Nazi flags snapped in the early morning breeze. Several aeroplanes stood ready for takeoff to drop bombs on England and across Europe. Guards marched in front of red signs that read, "Verboten, keep out under penalty of death." She kept walking. There were already four women queued up in front of the butcher shop when she arrived. She took her place at the back of the line. That was when she saw a piece of chalk lying in the road, tucked in against the curb. She knew instantly how she could use it. She glanced around, but no one was looking at her. Why would they be, when there were German soldiers everywhere? Men in uniform strode through town like peacocks buying whatever caught their eye. Rambunctious and loud and quick to laugh. They were unfailingly polite, opening doors for women and tipping their hats, but Isabel wasn't fooled. She bent down and palmed the bit of chalk, hiding it in her pocket. It felt dangerous and wonderful just having it. She tapped her foot impatiently after that, waiting for her turn.
"Good morning," she said, offering her ration card to the butcher's wife, a tired-looking woman with thinning hair and even thinner lips.
"Ham hocks, £2, that's what is left."
"Bones?"
"The Germans take all the good meat, mademoiselle. You're lucky, in fact. Pork is verboten for the French, don't you know? But they don't want the hocks. Do you want them or not?"
"I'll take them,"
someone said behind her.
"So will I,"
yelled another woman.
"I'll take them," Isabel said.
She took the small packet, wrapped up in wrinkled paper and tied with twine. Across the street, she heard the sound of jackboots marching on cobblestone, the rattling of sabers in scabbards, the sound of male laughter, and the purring voices of the French women who warmed their beds. A trio of German soldiers sat at a bistro table not far away.
"Mademoiselle," one of them said, waving to her, "come have coffee with us."
She clutched her willow basket with its paper-wrapped treasures, small and insufficient as they were, and ignored the soldiers. She slipped around the corner and into an alley that was narrow and crooked, like all such passageways in town. Entrances were slim, and from the street, they appeared to be dead ends. Locals knew how to navigate them as easily as a boatman knows a boggy river. She walked forward, unobserved. The shops in the alley had all been shut down. A poster in the abandoned milliner's shop window showed a crooked old man with a huge hooked nose, looking greedy and evil, holding a bag of money and trailing blood and bodies behind him. She saw the word Juif, Jew, and stopped. She knew she should keep walking. It was just propaganda, after all. The enemy's heavy-handed attempt to blame the Jewish people for the ills of the world and this war. And yet, she glanced to her left. Not 50 feet away was Rue La Grande, a main street through town. To her right was an elbow bend in the alleyway. She reached into her pocket and pulled out her piece of chalk. When she was sure the coast was clear, she drew a huge V for victory on the poster, obliterating as much of the image as she could. Someone grabbed her wrist so hard she gasped. Her piece of chalk fell, clattered to the cobblestones, and rolled into one of the cracks.
"Mademoiselle,"
a man said, shoving her against the poster she'd just defaced, pressing her cheek into the paper so that she couldn't see him.
"Do you know it is verboten to do that? And punishable by death?"
Chapter 10 Vianne closed her eyes and thought, "Hurry home, Antoine." It was all she allowed herself, just that one small plea. How could she handle all of this? War, and Captain Beck, and Isabel, alone. She wanted to daydream, pretend that her world was upright instead of fallen on its side, that the closed guest room door meant nothing, that Sophie had slept with Vianne last night because they'd fallen asleep reading, that Antoine was outside on this dewy dawn morning, chopping wood for a winter that was still months away. Soon he would come in and say,
"Well, I am off to a day of delivering mail."
Perhaps he would tell her of his latest postmark, a letter in from Africa or America, and he would spin her a romantically imagined tale to go along with it. Instead, she returned her knitting to the basket by the divan, put on her boots, and went outside to chop wood. It would be autumn again in no time, and then winter, and the devastation of her garden by the refugees had reminded her how perilously balanced her survival was. She lifted the axe and brought it down, hard. Grasp. Raise. Steady. Chop. Every chop reverberated up her arms and lodged painfully in the muscles of her shoulders. Sweat squeezed from her pores, dampened her hair.
"Allow me, please, to do this for you."
She froze, the axe in mid-air. Beck stood nearby, dressed in his breeches and boots, with only a thin white t-shirt covering his chest. His pale cheeks were reddened from a morning shave, and his blonde hair was wet. Droplets fell onto his t-shirt, making a pattern of small gray sunbursts. She felt acutely uncomfortable in her robe and work boots, with her hair pinned in curls. She lowered the axe.
"There are some things a man does around the house. You are much too fragile to chop wood."
"I can do it."
"Of course you can, but why should you? Go, madame. See to your daughter. I can do this small thing for you. Otherwise my mother will beat me with a switch."
She meant to move, but somehow she didn't. And then he was there, pulling the axe gently out of her hand. She held on instinctively for a moment. Their gazes met, held. She released her hold and stepped back so quickly she stumbled. He caught her by the wrist, steadied her. Mumbling a thank you, she turned and walked away from him, keeping her spine as straight as she could. It took all of her limited courage not to speed up. Even so, by the time she reached the door, she felt as if she'd run from Paris. She kicked free of the oversized gardening boots, saw them hit the house with a thunk and fall in a heap. The last thing she wanted was kindness from this man who had invaded her home. She slammed the door shut behind her and went to the kitchen, where she lit the stove and put a pot of water on to boil. Then she went to the bottom of the stairs and called her daughter down for breakfast. She had to call two more times, and then threaten, before Sophie came trudging down the stairs, her hair a mess, the look in her eyes sullen. She was wearing her sailor dress again. In the 10 months Antoine had been gone, she'd outgrown it, but she refused to stop wearing it.
"I'm up," she said,
shuffling to the table, taking her seat. Vianne placed a bowl of cornmeal mush in front of her daughter. She had splurged this morning and added a tablespoon of preserved peaches on top.
Maman, can't you hear that? There's someone knocking at the door.
Vianne shook her head. All she'd heard was the thunk, thunk, thunk of the axe and went to the door, opening it. Rachel stood there, with the baby in her arms and Sarah tucked in close to her side.
You are teaching today with your hair pinned?
Oh!
Vianne felt like a fool. What was wrong with her? Today was the last day of school before the summer break.
Let's go, Sophie. We are late.
She rushed back inside and cleared the table. Sophie had licked her plate clean, so Vianne laid it in the copper sink to wash later. She covered the leftover pot of mush and put the preserved peaches away. Then she ran upstairs to get ready. In no time, she had removed her hairpins and combed her hair into smooth waves. She grabbed her hat, gloves, and handbag and left the house to find Rachel and the children waiting in the orchard. Captain Beck was there too, standing by the shed. His white t-shirt was soaked in places and clung to his chest, revealing the whorls of hair beneath. He had the axe slung casually against one shoulder.
Ah, greetings, he said.
Vianne could feel Rachel's scrutiny. Beck lowered the axe.
This is a friend of yours, madame?
Rachel, Vianne said tightly. My neighbor. This is Herr Captain Beck. He is the one billeting with us.
Greetings,
Beck said again, nodding politely. Vianne put a hand on Sophie's back and gave her daughter a little shove, and they were off, trudging through the tall grass of the orchard and out onto the dusty road.
He's handsome,
Rachel said as they came to the airfield, which was abuzz with activity behind the coils of barbed wire.
You didn't tell me that.
Is he?
I'm pretty sure you know he is, so your question is interesting. What's he like?
German.
The soldiers billeted with Claire Moreau look like sausages with legs. I hear they drink enough wine to kill a judge and snore like rooting hogs. You're lucky, I guess.
You're the lucky one, Rachel. No one has moved into your house.
Poverty has its reward at last.
She linked her arm through Vianne's.
Don't look so stricken, Vianne. I hear they have orders to be correct.
Vianne looked at her best friend.
Last week, Isabel chopped off her hair in front of the captain and said beauty must be verboten.
Rachel couldn't stifle her smile completely.
Oh.
It's hardly funny. She could get us killed with her temper.
Rachel's smile faded.
Can you talk to her?
Oh, I can talk. When has she ever listened to anyone?
You are hurting me,
Isabel said. The man yanked her away from the wall and dragged her down the street. Moving so fast, she had to run along beside him. She bumped into the stone alley wall with every step. When she tripped on a cobblestone and almost fell, he tightened his hold and held her upright.
Think, Isabel.
He wasn't in uniform, so he must be Gestapo. That was bad. And he'd seen her defacing the poster. Did it count as an act of sabotage or espionage or resistance to the German occupation? It wasn't like blowing up a bridge or selling secrets to Britain.
I was making art. It was going to be a vase full of flowers, not a V for victory, a vase.
No resistance, just a silly girl drawing on the only paper she could find. I have never even heard of General de Gaulle. And what if they didn't believe her? The man stopped in front of an oak door with a black lion's head knocker at its center. He rapped four times on the door.
Where are you taking me?
Was this a back door to the Gestapo headquarters? There were terrible rumors about these Gestapo interrogators. Supposedly they were ruthless and sadistic, but no one knew for sure. The door opened slowly, revealing an old man in a beret. A hand-rolled cigarette hung from his fleshy, liver-spotted lips. He saw Isabel and frowned.
Open up!
The man beside Isabel growled, and the old man stepped aside. Isabel was pulled into a room full of smoke. Her eyes stung as she looked around. It was an abandoned novelty store that had once sold bonnets and notions and sewing supplies. In the smoky light, she saw empty display cases that had been shoved up against the walls. Empty metal hat racks were piled in the corner. The window out front had been bricked up, and the back door that faced Rue La Grande was padlocked from the inside. There were four men in the room. A tall, graying man, dressed in rags, standing in the corner. A boy seated beside the old man who had opened the door. And a handsome young man in a tattered sweater and worn pants with scuffed boots who sat at a cafe table.
"Who is this, Didier?"
asked the old man who had opened the door. Isabel got the first good look at her captor. He was big and brawny, with the puffed-up look of a circus strongman and a heavily jowled, oversized face. She stood as tall as possible, with her shoulders pressed back and her chin lifted. She knew she looked ridiculously young in her plaid skirt and fitted blouse, but she refused to give them the satisfaction of knowing she was afraid.
"I found her chalking V's on the German posters," said the swarthy man who'd caught her, Didier.
Isabel fisted her right hand, trying to rub the orange chalk away without them noticing.
"Have you nothing to say?"
said the old man standing in the corner. He was the boss, obviously.
"I have no chalk."
"I saw her doing it."
Isabel took a chance.
"You're not German," she said to the strong man. "You're French. I'd bet money on it. And you," she said to the old man, "you're the pork butcher."
The boy she dismissed altogether, but to the handsome young man in the tattered clothes she said,
"You look hungry, and I think you're wearing your brother's clothes or something you found hanging on a line somewhere. Communist."
He grinned at her, and it changed his whole demeanor. But it was the man in the corner she cared about, the one in charge. She took a step toward him.
"You could be Aryan. Maybe you're forcing the others to be here."
"I've known him all my life, mademoiselle," the pork butcher said. "I fought beside his father, and yours, at Somme. You're Isabel Rossignol, oui?"
She didn't answer. Was it a trap?
"No answer," said the Bolshevik.
He rose from his seat, came toward her.
"Good for you. Why were you chalking a V on the poster?"
Again, Isabel remained silent.
"I am Henri Navarre," he said, close enough now to touch her. "We are not Germans, nor do we work with them, mademoiselle."
He gave her a meaningful look.
"Not all of us are passive. Now why were you marking up their posters?"
"It was all I could think of," she said.
"Meaning?"
She exhaled evenly.
"I heard de Gaulle's speech on the radio."
Henri turned to the back of the room, sent a glance to the old man. She watched the two men have an entire conversation around her without speaking a word. At the end of it, she knew who the boss was, the handsome communist, Henri. At last Henri said, turning to her again,
"If you could do something, more, would you?"
"What do you mean?"
she asked.
"There is a man in Paris. A group, actually, from the Musée de l'Homme,"
the burly man corrected him. Henri held up a hand.
"We don't say more than we must, Didier. Anyway, there is a man, a printer, risking his life to make tracts that we can distribute. Maybe if we can get the French to wake up to what is happening, we have a chance."
Henri reached into a leather bag that hung on his chair and pulled out a sheaf of papers. A headline jumped out at her. "Vive le Général de Gaulle." The text was an open letter to Maréchal Pétain that expressed criticism of the surrender. At the end it read, "Nous sommes pour le Général de Gaulle." We support General de Gaulle.
"Well?"
Henri said quietly. And in that single word, Isabel heard the call to arms she'd been waiting for.
"Will you distribute them?"
Me?
We are communists and radicals.